Hello and welcome to Books and Beer. I am your host, Mike Malone. I'm here at the Craft Beer Sanctuary, The Oath, in Tarrytown, New York. Every time I drive here, I see another stage of the Tappan Zee Bridge being built over the Hudson. Today's guest may just be the best qualified person to appear on Books and Beer that we've ever had. After all, he's a professional brewer and an author, and he's won considerable acclaim for his book and his beer. Derek Dellinger is the brewmaster at Kent Falls Brewing in Connecticut. He is the writer of the beer blog Bear Flavored and author of The Fermented Man, A Year on the Front Lines of a Food Revolution. We'll talk to Derek in a minute about his book, and we will also sample the Peak Organic The Juice Pale Ale, and we'll sample Blue Point's Prop Stopper. And Derek, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Back when this was a radio show, about a year ago, we had you there as well. So always good to have a repeat guest. And tell us how the book came to be.
The book came to be a few years ago. I mean, it seems like forever now. I feel like I've been working on this project for half my life. But I guess that is the nature of the publishing industry. Things happen slowly. And I had this idea years ago, back in the days when fermentation was, you know, more obscure and people were just getting into homebrewing, a lot more so than they are today. Was getting into homebrewing myself and started to, you know, kind of dabble in some other fermented things and just increasing my awareness of, you know, these different bacteria and yeast that, as far as my interests went, mostly made, you know, these different wild and funky, wild fermented beers. And then realizing that they extended to other foods as well. And I just kind of was one day walking through the grocery store, the Natural Market in Beacon, and looking at, they had a small section of lacto-fermented foods, which I had never seen before in my entire life. These foods advertising that they were fermented by bacteria, mm-hmm. and proud of it, because it seems like food normally is, you know, food industry is normally terrified of bacteria and terrified of microbes, and even in foods that are fairly commonly known to be fermented, like, say, yogurt, doesn't advertise that it's fermented on the packaging. It still kind of tries to use other words, like cultured, to obscure that fact and, you know, not weird people out. And here in this Natural Market were these foods that were really proudly advertising the bacteria, and they were live culture, that they hadn't been pasteurized, the bacteria was still alive. And I was fascinated by that, and made me realize how ubiquitous this process is and how commonplace some of these bacteria and yeast are that make these different fermented foods, and they can be found across the entire food spectrum. So from there, that kind of light bulb moment, this sort of like matrixy moment of seeing the world a whole new way, snowballed. And I was like, oh wow, these bacteria, these microbes are in, you know, fermented meats, cured meats like salami and prosciutto, and of course bread and yogurt, commonplace things that we think of like beer and sauerkraut, but it extends across every type of food that we all, you know, all of us eat on a fairly regular basis. Pretty much anything you can think of can be fermented. So the kind of logical or probably illogical next thought in that chain was, wow, you could live off of fermented food if you were crazy enough. And it's certainly something within the realm of possibility, but not something that most sane people would try to do. But being a not a sane person myself, I thought it would be an interesting project and an interesting experiment. And one thing led to another, and I had the opportunity to write a book about that. So I went forward with it and pursued it because I thought it would be an interesting way to just demonstrate to people how broad the world of fermented food is. People don't realize, you know, a lot of these foods are fermented, or that fermentation can reach into every type of food we eat. So I thought doing something so extreme and so jarringly different from how most people, you know, view their food, I thought that would be a good way to hopefully highlight to people, to, you know, people uninitiated in the world of fermentation, to demonstrate, you know, what the world of fermentation is and right. how important and ubiquitous it is.
Okay, and so the challenge was living for a year on fermented foods. Only a couple exceptions for what, flavorings, condiments?
Yeah, I mean, well, so most condiments are fermented or are largely fermented, because vinegar is kind of the baseline of most condiments anyway. So in the case of a lot of condiments, you could almost view it at, you know, say mustard is basically vinegar with spices in it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, you know, we made some ground rules, my editor and I, for this book, you know, decided on a year would be the length of the challenge, because it just seemed like a, you know, hard enough, but without, you know, doable, but very challenging.
Yeah.
And things like water I would need to survive. Otherwise, everything pretty much had to be fermented. Unless we can make the argument that it didn't count as a food. So in the case of spices, like, a spice isn't really a food. You're clearly not living off of spices. You're not getting sustenance from them. So we kind of said, you know, that doesn't count as a food. But it does open up some, like, kind of blurred lines where, yeah, in the case of mustard, does that count? I mean, it is primarily a fermented product with some spices in it. Some stuff like that, I pretty much said, okay, this is allowed. And again, like, I'm not living off of mustard, clearly. Like, you can't cheat by you know, I couldn't be like, well, I have to eat only fermented food, but I'm really going to, like, live off of mustard.
People have tried that with not a lot of success.
I love mustard, but yeah, it's not a food. It's a flavoring. And it does happen to be primarily fermented anyway. So, yeah, most condiments, involve... Yeah, a lot. Some condiments are entirely fermented, like Tabasco sauce, very, very common hot sauce, possibly the most popular hot sauce in America.
Yeah,
is fermented for 2 to 3 years in barrels. It's still by the traditional process that they've been following for years and years and years.
So, right. Yeah. What was kind of the low point in this year? Like, the point when you were closest to just scrapping it and saying, I just want to go for a bacon cheeseburger?
I mean, there were probably many of them over pretty much the whole final 6 months of the project. It was very, very challenging. It was easily the most, well, arguably I could say the first year of running a brewery was equally as difficult, but living off of fermented food for a year is certainly...
Well, these were overlapping.
And they started to overlap, unfortunately, not too much. The brewery was just opening at the end of the year.
Okay.
Like, just, we didn't actually brew the first batch of beer until several months after I was done with the diet, but we were putting in the tanks and ramping everything up and doing test batches. Fortunately, they didn't overlap too much, or I probably would have died. But yeah, I mean, certainly one of the most challenging things I've ever done in my life, if not the most challenging. And there were times where I was like, you know, is this worth it? Is this book going to be that interesting or that good?
Yeah.
And I did believe in, you know, in the project and in myself and hopefully my ability to make an interesting, compelling book. But it is a lot to go through just for, you know, a book that a couple thousand people might read and hopefully find some enjoyment out of. I never broke the diet. I mean, there were a few times I think I unwittingly maybe had a small morsel of something unfermented, but I never, like, broke down and went and got McDonald's or anything like that. So I made it through. And yeah, I mean, you just kind of get into a routine. I was going through a lot in my life that year. So it was challenging on a personal level, as well as just the logistical level of doing it.
Sure.
But at a certain point, you're just kind of like, well, this is just a hard year, but I set out to do this for a reason, and I'm just going to take it day by day and get through it. And yeah, ultimately, I look back on it now that I'm done and can comfortably eat whatever I want. I look back on it positively as a worthwhile experience in my life and a very interesting project and period of my life.
But sure.
I don't know that I could do it again.
Right. What was your go-to meal?
My go-to meal would kind of resemble like a sort of fancy appetizer platter or sort of something you might get at like a high-end restaurant where they bring out to you some cured meats, some charcuterie. You get a charcuterie plate and a cheese plate, and maybe you have some kind of pickled vegetables on the side, and you have bread and butter. Cultured butter is fermented, so I could have bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of my average meal would either be, it's sort of like you could think of it as like fancy appetizer platter, cheese plate, meat plate, with some veggies on the side. Or, I mean, another way to look at it is a lot of this stuff, when you think about it, it's just you're eating a deconstructed sandwich, which is kind of a meal staple for a lot of people on a regular basis. A lot of people eat sandwiches every day for lunch.
Sure.
And the stuff I was eating was pretty much just a sandwich, but I wouldn't necessarily put it into the form of the sandwich. I would just kind of eat it deconstructed.
Right.
Or I could make a sandwich out of it. I mean, I certainly ate a lot of grilled cheese throughout this year, because bread and cheese are easy, obviously, and you make a kimchi grilled cheese or a sauerkraut grilled cheese or kind of a tempeh Reuben with tempeh is like a fermented soybean. So there's a lot of different things you can like do to modify, you know, basic meals that we eat on a regular basis. And again, we don't realize how much fermentation is already playing a role in those things and the right. sandwiches and, you know, pizza and all these things that are just sort of rearrangements of core foods that are very commonplace.
Sure. And what was the first meal that or first thing you ate after your year was over?
I was really looking forward to avocados again. I actually had one fermented avocado during the year.
Yeah.
I found a cafe in New Orleans when I was visiting my sister down there that had this very unique fermented avocado. It was done with this kind of obscure Japanese pickling method that's not very common in Western society. Amazing fermented avocado. It was really incredible. It just had this kind of like slightly aged, funky, fermented quality to it, but it still more or less tasted like a fresh avocado. It was really eye-opening, and I tried to replicate that recipe, that process at home, and I failed miserably. So, avocados are something that, you know, as anyone who likes avocados know, they kind of start to turn brown and weird, like even just sitting out normally for a few minutes. So they're really something that kind of embodies the need for freshness. Like you really want to just cut open an avocado and eat it immediately. So it's kind of the flip side of the whole fermentation preservation spectrum.
Sure, sure.
And something that I started to really crave badly. So yeah, stroke of midnight, New Year's Eve, 2015, when my diet ended, I dove right into a bowl of guacamole, and it was very satisfying.
At what point on New Year's Eve day were you just kind of counting down like the rest of the country, but were you saying, oh, 12 hours until I could just bury my face in the bowl of guacamole?
You know, it actually wasn't so bad. I would say the months leading up to the end of the year were when I was kind of like, I was counting down, you know, obviously not the hours, but I was counting down the days and months through the late summer and fall. At the end of the year, I mean, December was tough, but that time of year always kind of moves fast, fortunately. Yeah. I also made a trip to Iceland to try a Icelandic delicacy, rotten shark meat, as kind of the culmination of my project. I wanted to try...
Hakarl,
yeah.
Hakarl.
One of the most extreme foods in the world. So, I mean, that's a whole other story, but I had made that trip between Christmas and New Year's and essentially got back from a late flight, got back to my apartment in Beacon the morning of New Year's Eve.
Okay.
And so I'd been traveling, so I didn't, you know, I was pretty out of it. I was pretty tired. I had been traveling for the last like 6 days.
Yeah.
So that day fortunately kind of flew by, because the whole week before New Year's flew by because I was doing so much and traveling and having what was ultimately like a really great, interesting experience. And I'm glad I timed it like that, because it really made what would have been otherwise a very difficult week to get
Absolutely.
Through actually quite enjoyable, and it moved very quickly. And it actually snuck up on me. I mean, you'd think I would have been just standing there like counting the hours.
Right.
But it was actually like kind of a very great, satisfying day. And my friend who works for DeChico's, who's the manager of DeChico's in Brewster, great local grocery store chain.
And we love DeChico's here.
Yeah, of course. So he was having a New Year's Eve party at his house, and of course, obviously, there was a lot of great food there, and he specifically had some DeChico's guacamole for me set aside
that was nice. Wow.
Just for me, which is great. So thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, that's what friends are for.
Yeah, so it was a great experience. I was hanging out with some... some local brewers and good friends, Evan Watson from Plan B. And
Plan B, I see he's got an event going on.
He has
here
an event here on the 18th.
The 18th of October?
Wait, that's already
past
gone.
That, okay.
Yep.
Must be November 18th.
Well, if you have a time machine, if not. Yeah, so, and Chris Basso of Newberg Brewery actually had some venison prosciutto that he made.
Nice.
It was amazing, you know, cured, fermented venison meat, which I had never had before. So I had this like amazing array, and I could eat that, of course, on the diet. So I had this amazing array of food available to me at this party in good company, and it was not excruciating. Fortunately,
good.
It was a very good, very memorable, good occasion.
Good, glad to hear it. So tell us about Kent Falls Brewing.
Kent Falls is a farmhouse brewery in northwestern Connecticut, outside of the town of Kent. It's about 30 minutes north of Danbury, Danbury, Connecticut. So it started, the whole project was started several years ago by the, there's a group of owners. One of them owns the property. One of them manages the brewery, Barry. Two of them are in Portchester, New York at Neversink Distillery, which is kind of a side project of the company.
What's the name of the distillery?
Neversink Spirits.
Oh, right, right, yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, so we also have a distillery in Portchester, New York. And, you know, we don't really work with them on a day-to-day basis, but we're all kind of part of the same project.
Yeah.
So Barry, the co-owner and manager of the brewery, was, you know, on the farm for the last couple of years, along with our farm manager, John, working to get this farm together, and the farm now operates as a, you know, a separate business, and the brewery is located on the farm. But it's a very cool idea, very cool project, where the farm can kind of, you know, grow hops and other ingredients for the brewery. We don't use, you know, everything from the farm, obviously, these are just issues of scale and what we can do with the land.
Sure.
But the two kind of enterprises exist symbiotically and benefit one another, and you know, we're able to take our spent grain right out and compost it on the farm or feed it to the animals. And the farmer's able to help us and use the tractor and, you know, all these different kind of elements that make the two businesses work well together. And I got involved. They approached me, and they were looking for a brewer, and we had similar tastes in what we wanted to do. I was brewing a lot of farmhouse beer and obviously wild fermented things, you know, going along with my book project. And
your obsession.
So we were, you know, interested in similar types of beer, and I worked with them over the summer when I was doing this book project, when I was doing far too many different things. I just initially worked with them to kind of develop the wild fermentation program there, and we cultured some indigenous microbes from the farm, which we've since released that beer, Fingerprints, wild fermented beer with microbes, you know, from the farm itself, which is really cool. And so we did some other experiments like that. And then eventually, before the brewery opened, I took the job as the head brewer. So I've been working with them to kind of develop the, you know, sort of combining my ideas for, you know, what I appreciated about beer and the types of beer that I like to drink with, you know, their vision of this farmhouse brewery, adapted to the land and, you know, brewing in harmony with the land and, creating, you know, flavors specific to that brewery.
Yeah.
So we're doing a lot of cool, like farmhouse wild sour type beers and also some clean IPAs and, mainly just like refreshing, easy drinking beers that are things that we want to drink.
Sure.
We kind of brew for ourselves, and it's mostly lighter, paler beers. We don't do a lot of heavier, boozy stuff, stuff that we, you know, would find refreshing after working a hard day on the farm or in the brewery. So that's kind of the vision there.
Okay. Well, a good segue into sampling a beer. You up for,
yeah,
for a brew? Okay, we've got the Peak. Let me give you a little background on this beer here. It is Peak Organic, the Juice IPA out of Maine, a wicked dry hopped pale ale, charismatic cousin to super fresh, tangerine and berry notes explode in the aroma and juicy hop flavors burst on the scene at first sip. Brewed with Amarillo, Citra, Simcoe, and one of our favorite new hops, can you guess?
Azaka.
Azaka, yes.
Wow, I'm so good.
Okay, well, let's
totally blindly guess that without having read that description.
Did you really?
No.
Okay.
Cheers. Tastes very charismatic.
Yeah. First sip. What do they promise with first? Okay, juicy hops flavor burst on the scene at first sip. Fair assessment.
Yeah. It's, excuse me.
You got a sniffle.
Fall allergies, food poisoning, and a couple days of being sick all hit me.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Once. Yeah.
Sorry to hear it. Jeez. Interesting color.
Yeah, it's it is up the, certainly up my alley.
Yeah.
The type of beers I like to brew and drink.
Mm-hmm.
Not overly bitter. It's, you know, refreshing and clean, light, drinkable.
Clean comes to mind. Not a word I usually associate with an IPA, but that's got a really nice smooth taste to it.
It is the direction, I think. It's certainly the direction the industry is moving with IPAs more and more.
Yeah. How do you define clean for an IPA?
And just kind of lacking in abrasive qualities, lacking in things that are kind of like slapping you across the face. So something that's just kind of, a lot of these words are sort of nebulous. If you say something smooth, like, okay, what does that mean? It's all kind of, you're just grasping for words to define something kind of that's kind of inherently intangible. Clean, is kind of lacking in abrasive qualities, smooth, which, whatever you want to define smooth as.
Is it a lower ABV, typically?
It can be. I think it's a word that other people use. I don't think it's just me, but to me, I kind of actually associate it with music. So I listen to a small amount, but fairly frequently get in the mood to listen to some metal music. In the metal genre of music, and possibly in other genres of music, clean singing denotes what you would think of as normal standard singing.
Okay.
You're singing, melodically, in your normal singing voice. And in metal, what people think of as metal vocals, the kind of growling, screaming, rasping, there's actually like a dozen different styles of metal vocals, but that kind of harsher growling style of quote-unquote singing, or whatever you want to call it, it's used to differentiate those two. So you have metal vocals, the harsher, abrasive type of vocals, and then you have clean singing. And some bands will do both. Many bands are notable.
So that's an actual subgenre of heavy metal, clean singing.
It's an element of different subgenres of metal or all of metal, and some bands will use both styles of singing, so you have that contrast. You can switch between a contrast of kind of abrasive, growling and, severe vocals, and then this kind of pleasant, clean style of vocals that is, what most people associate with music. So it's an interesting contrast, and to me, in my head, I can kind of, I know what clean means because I can kind of make that comparison.
Okay.
Or like, oh, this is easier. This is like the harmonious, melodic, It's not harsh, it's not abrasive, it's not trying to hit you with, 10% alcohol or really heavy, severe malt flavors or sharp, bitter hops or, something that's kind of jarring and intimidating. Okay. It's just clean,
Clean, interesting. Yeah. What's a metal band with clean vocals?
So probably the best example is a fairly well-known metal band that's been popular for about 20 years now, but called Opeth. And they're, I think from Sweden, but a Scandinavian band that sort of pioneered this. Like, they do the growling, harsh vocals.
Yeah.
They can sound like what people stereotype a metal band to sound like, but switch very fluidly into these, kind of beautiful melodic segments too with clean singing as well. So Opeth is a good band to check out.
It sounds like a little like a description of System of a Down. Would that be
sure? They kind of they kind of do that too. They kind of adapted that contrast in a different way. Obviously they have a very unique sound, but they do kind of
somebody obviously with a great set of pipes.
Right, exactly.
That can use it, for melodic purposes or for more kind of punch in the face.
Exactly. And it is cool to have that. Yeah, I mean, if you appreciate both vocal styles, it's kind of, it allows the band to create an interesting contrast.
Definitely.
Contrast is always interesting.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you to The Peak for the wonderful Juice IPA that we are sampling today. So in terms of you ending up at Kent Falls, they found you through your beer blog.
Through my blog, yeah. Interesting. It is strange what blogging can accomplish.
So what is it? Bear.flavored.com, right?
Bear-flavored.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what I meant to say. Bear-flavored.com. Okay.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you got that email or that phone call initially?
I mean, obviously it was a very interesting time in my life. I had been trying to get into the beer industry for a few years and sort of exploring different options and had been thinking about and trying to start my own brewery and a homebrew shop. Opening in Beacon, kind of had the same experience with them 6 months earlier, where this guy starting homebrew shop read my blog and reached out and asked if I wanted to be a manager for the homebrew shop. So I was kind of going through this crazy phase of my life where I was really trying to like figure out what I wanted to do with my life, with my career, how to push my career in
different
directions.
And you were directions. A journalist.
I was a writer by trade at that time, working on a very demanding book project. Had been working for a Navy trade magazine. So I had all these things happening, and for better or worse, was kind of diving at every opportunity that came my way, because mm-hmm. I was like, well, this is, what you're supposed to do. It was not as easy to figure out as most people would probably think, where you're like, oh, a brewery, it wants you to be the brewer there, like, dream job, go for it. But I had so much going on, I was worried about my ability to be able to successfully do it all. And it's also intimidating going on to be a head brewer at a fairly sizable, actually, much larger than most new breweries are.
Yeah. What was the biggest brewing quantity you had done before out of
just
your...
pretty much 5 gallons.
Okay.
So I was scaling up by a factor of literally 100, more than that. So I was going from, the brew system is 15 barrels, which is about 500 gallons, but
okay.
we had 30 or have 30 barrel tanks. Now we have a range of different tank sizes, but most of the tanks are 30 barrels, which is about 1,000 gallons. So I was going from brewing 5 gallons of beer in my kitchen to 1,000 gallons of beer
mm-hmm.
that would be distributed and consumed by thousands of people across the region, which is a very intimidating proposition.
Absolutely.
Even if you're relatively confident in your abilities, which I'm not really a confident person.
But the reviews have been great. I've not heard a bad word about
people,
any of your
people
beers
do
yet.
Seem to like it, yeah.
I mean, these are kind of the hardcore beer intelligentsia folks, too, that are,
right.
are absolutely falling for this brew. So I guess you're doing something right.
Yeah, it is good to hear the feedback. I try to avoid reading reviews in general, both for my book and the beer. I just find it's kind of unnecessarily... I don't know. It can mess with your head, and it can be good or it can be bad. But
you
I
must
find
be tempted.
Just,
no,
no. I did read some reviews at the beginning, and they're mostly positive. But at a certain point, I was just like, I don't gain anything by reading these reviews.
Okay.
Like, you have to be your own harshest critic.
Right.
If there's something you're uncertain about, you hopefully have a circle of people who are knowledgeable and skilled and can give you useful feedback. But if you absorb the opinion of every single guy on the internet with an opinion to share, you'll just drive yourself crazy.
Absolutely,
One of the weirdest parts of this experience is that it is right now, for better or worse, a very opinionated industry. It is an industry that's really kind of thriving sort of on opinions as much as just, basic consumerism. So it's an interesting world, and I think, especially as a brewer, you can't focus on it too much, or you'll just drive yourself crazy.
Right. In terms of being a brewer, I mean, like you hinted at before, it sounds like a dream job, but it's a difficult, physically and emotionally and psychologically taxing line of work,
It's not
what people think? Maybe.
Not what people think. And you hear that all the time, and I heard that before I took the job, and I heard that, in many different ways, and you just kind of dismiss it because you're like, well, beer, I don't know, like, it must be great. Like, you get to drink beer, you make beer at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But pretty much every brewer that I've ever talked to is not as like, oh yeah, this is so great. I just make beer and then I hang out and I drink. They're not leading the easy, carefree dream life that people seem to think they are. Like, it is a really challenging job. It's immensely stressful. You have this kind of baseline anxiety clouding you at all times, where you're like, there are thousands of things that you can mess up with, from the start to the end of the beer process. It's an incredibly volatile, fragile kind of process. It's not necessarily like other things where you kind of finish it and it's done. Like, things can go wrong at any point, long after you've released the beer into the market. Things will continue to maybe go wrong because it's a living thing and it can evolve and change, and there's all sorts of ways it can be mistreated. So you're like, there's 1,000 points at which something can go wrong, and, we might ruin a reputation, or it, like I said, it's a very opinionated industry. Release a bad batch of beer that all of a sudden like people turn on you for, or you just might make a mistake and destroy tens of thousands of dollars worth of product. Geez. And so that's kind of always hanging over your head. So it's very stressful. It's physically demanding. You're wet and moist all the time. Your feet are in these sogging wet socks, and you know, might get sprayed in the face with hot liquor or dangerous chemicals or all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you're very tired and you need a beer very badly, but it's not quite the same sort of experience as when you're just you know, a beer enthusiast going to the bottle shop and picking up something exciting.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
And in terms of the fermented food community, the movement, and I assume there is a good-sized community.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly more and more. I mean, would have been much smaller if we were talking 3-4 years ago when I first had this idea.
Yeah.
At this point, it is really becoming a kind of an established community and movement.
What was their reaction to you and the book?
Well, I had kind of a lot of opportunities, unique opportunities to promote this book that you wouldn't necessarily have for many other types of books, where this is at least something based on kind of an activity that I can perform in a workshop to demonstrate to people.
Okay.
So I can do a sauerkraut workshop, which is really nice because I can do something. I actually kind of hate, so far, my least favorite way of promoting this book is doing a book reading, because you're just kind of standing up in front of people, reading off the page. And even though I like what I wrote, it feels weird just reading what you wrote.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can relate or not. Obviously, you've done that as well. It just feels slightly weird and unnatural, where I'd almost rather speak spontaneously than just kind of regurgitate.
I think nonfiction is tough to read.
It
in
is.
A public setting,
yeah.
too. Maybe fiction, it's a little bit more storytelling-ish.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. And you're kind of, I mean, I'm sure a lot of writers have this too. I mean, as a writer, I can't stop editing. So I'm like still editing as I'm reading. And you're like, How did I leave that word? Yeah. So like, I can't turn it off. And like, I'm like still critiquing my work as I'm reading it to these people. And like, I'll like change things on the fly because I'm like, I don't like that. That's, why did I write that? How did that get in? How's that still in here?
Right.
So I find that very stressful, but doing workshops and presentations and things like that, it's a lot easier to connect with people too, because I find it to be a little more interactive. So I've gotten to do a lot of workshops. There's a lot of fermentation festivals out there now, which is kind of, I think, a sign of how big this movement has gotten. They're kind of festivals springing up, catered just to, you know, the world of fermented foods all over the place. I've seen them, you know, dozens pop up in the last couple of years that just didn't exist when I started this project.
Right.
And I've gotten to talk to a lot of people in the world of fermentation through those events, so. It's been great. I mean, people are curious. Obviously, it is kind of an extreme idea, so there's...
Any pushback that people thought that the conceit was gimmicky or anything?
No,
like that?
I'm sure some people think that. No one's, like, said that to me.
Okay, that's good.
It is, you know, it is obviously, yeah, like I said, it's an extreme idea, so I do have to... You're trying to sell to fermentation people who already know about fermentation, so
right.
They already kind of get it. And that type of person generally has been interested. I've gotten a lot of good feedback from that crowd. And I was also hoping to, you know, get this out into the mainstream more, people that don't know what fermentation is, people that don't understand how I could have possibly lived off these things for a year. And that was really the hope, you know, the hope is that it would educate those people and give them a window into fermentation that they might not have otherwise pursued. And it is still hard to, you know, to capture the interest of that audience, because they don't know about it, so they don't know why they should care. And you have to do a bit more work, you know, with the sales pitch and everything.
Sure. Now, talking about editing your book to the bitter end here, how many times would you say you read your manuscript?
Oh, man.
Do you ever count?
No. I actually, with this one... Not as much as I've edited other things. I've written things, you know, since, even like kind of trying to figure out what my next project will be, where you have to, you know, think about you're presenting to agents and other people, and I can easily just I'll get caught in kind of an obsessive loop where just like as almost as like a comfort mechanism to like reassure myself that I'm not a complete fraud and failure. Just you're just like rereading it every day, and you're like, now I got to read it again. I got to read it again.
Gosh, that sounds grueling.
So there's things that I've read probably dozens of times. This, I don't know. I think maybe I had a bit more confidence with this project where, I was working directly with a really good editor. Had confidence that he would, tell me what needed to be changed, if anything. And it was also such an intense experience that I was almost, I think, less insecure about the manuscript itself than I was just kind of anxious about everything else that I had sure. to do to go into this. So I think there's enough with this one to kind of quell my normal OCD editing tendencies. And, I still probably read through the whole thing a dozen or so times.
Okay.
But that's, an accumulation of 2 years of right. kind of going back to it.
And you got this book deal without an agent, right?
Yeah. So, maybe that is normally how the publishing industry works. Maybe not. I don't know. It was just kind of a freak occurrence where I had this idea and I happened to mention it around someone who was an editor at a publishing company. So it all just kind of happened by happenstance. I don't know that I would have pursued it, going through agents, trying to find a book deal, all that effort, because I probably would have eventually, after pitching a couple agents, been like, well, this is such a crazy idea. Like, I would have started to get insecure, but, for better or worse, I think this is the sort of project that just kind of happens out of that pure moment of randomness and,
yep.
and, perfect timing, and it was the right time. And in our culture now, where fermentation is, as this book's coming out, just kind of becoming commonly, talked about. It's starting to enter the mainstream. So just everyone involved thought the timing was perfect.
Good.
And so it happened.
All right, let's do some Blue Point. What was this one called? The
Something with Seaweed.
The Prop Stopper Seaweed IPA. Let me tell you about this one. And I should make note here that our last show, we did have Blue Point as well. We had the Blue Point Oktoberfest. We generally do not repeat a brewery 2 shows in a row, but always trust the good folks here at the Oath in Tarrytown to pick out a good one. And the owner Joe thought that the seaweed component of this one would be particularly intriguing for our guest. So a seaweed IPA with 4 different types of seaweed added makes for a 7.7% ABV brew. The Blue Point Prop Stopper Seaweed IPA from out on Long Island. I'm gonna give this thing a smell, see if I pick up the sea here at all. Smells like an IPA. What are you smelling? Anything?
I don't really get seaweed, yeah.
No. Give it a taste.
I mean, it really does kind of, if you just gave me this and told me it was an IPA, I don't think I'd flinch.
Right.
I don't think I'd be like, there's something aquatic in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my impulse would be to throw something in. Throw seaweed in something briny. Like, I would probably throw it in Goza, which is brewed with sea salt.
Yeah.
And that's probably, like, too obvious of an idea, because
right.
maybe it seems like, of course you would do that. So this is an interesting direction for it, and I'm not very familiar with the properties of seaweed in beer, so it seems like it's probably kind of a mild ingredient. A
right.
lot of things, it's hard to get the essence of them to come through, where you're like, you expect this to taste like what you imagine it would taste like.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't really, so you kind of have to...
A little bit of a funk to it. Trying out my new adjective, thanks to you, we had the clean IPA of Peak. I'd say this is probably not in the same category of cleanness, huh?
No, yeah, I mean, I would say this is System of a Down vocals, maybe. Like,
okay.
It's
right.
not like aggressive metal vocals, but it's not Josh Groban either.
Okay.
Obviously listeners can't see this, but it's quite a bit darker than the last
much,
beer.
Much, much, much darker. Hard to believe they're in the same family here.
Sure, yeah. And this, so it's more of what, IPAs were 10 years ago. As far as color, it's got more of an amber hue to it.
Yep.
So you can tell it's going to be probably like a bit more aggressive and old school.
Yep. A couple points higher on the ABV scale as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, probably a bit boozier. Well, you can look at the menu, I guess. Yeah, a bit boozier. A little sharper, heavier malt flavors, a little sharper hop profile, all in all, just kind of a bit more aggressive of a beer.
Do you like it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You don't have to like anything here. We're
I'm pretty easy to please.
You are. Actually. Okay, good. Yeah, no, that's a tasty one. Interesting choice. I knew Joe would do a good job of giving us a couple.
Just like a little bit. I mean, it's reminiscent of hop flavors, and it might just be the hops in it. You get like a little something, you're like, that might be the seaweed.
But yeah.
It's certainly not like an aggressive, you know, smash you across the face.
Right. So seaweed, that's not a trend that you're seeing in brewing, is it?
Well, I don't know. Let's see in a couple months.
Right.
If we see a couple more seaweed IPAs, maybe. This is the first one I've had.
Yeah. Well, Blue Point is out on the water.
It makes sense.
Of Long Island.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Using some local ingredients, presumably. So what other trends are you seeing? I mean, just from my perspective in the brewing world, and I'm not nearly as in deep as you are, but the session IPAs seem to be everywhere. The grapefruit IPAs seem to be everywhere. But what are you saying? What's next?
Session IPAs obviously have kind of been dominating for, I guess, a few years now. I mean, it's interesting because I think there's trends within brewers and what brewers want to drink and make.
Yep.
And then the general beer consumer. And obviously, as a brewer now, I kind of am privy to get to talk to that kind of inner circle of brewers. And what I, you know, see there is a lot of people are kind of shifting towards, you know, again, cleaner beers, simpler beers, more session beers. Brewers are kind of, you know, getting tired of the market's need for these big, huge, boozy beers.
Yeah.
People would like to see more session beers and things under 6% that you can have several pints of.
Is that the craft industry just kind of moving a little bit more into the mainstream?
I think, you know, just in general, like the industry has been at, you know, at this need for big, boozy, heavy-handed flavors for so long now. And it still is, but brewers are kind of getting sick of it because they can't, you know, you get sick of drinking that after work.
Right.
Without, you know, being completely hosed.
Yeah.
And I think the general beer consumer is moving back towards that too, but it's definitely being led by brewers, and I'm seeing a lot of brewers now, you know, shifting back towards like, hey, pilsners are okay. Like, it's okay to enjoy a pilsner. And I don't know that the, you know, beer nerds are quite on that page yet where no one's lining up and you know, raving about pilsners. Because the industry is still kind of, like I said, hype and opinion focused.
Yeah.
So that will automatically gravitate towards extremes. But brewers seem to want to see a shift back towards, you know, easy drinking, sessionable, clean beers like pilsners, like session IPAs, like pale ales.
Yeah.
You know, things that you can just have and enjoy and you don't need to, you know, necessarily hype through the roof. So that's, I think, probably the trend. You know, I think the brewers might lead it and the general consumer might follow. And I hope to see maybe a less hype-driven market where we can just appreciate simple beers like pilsners that aren't necessarily something you'd wait in line 4 hours for.
But right, right.
Are, you know, those type of beers, not necessarily pilsners alone, but many other beers of that similar drinkability and accessibility, you know, we need that. It's there's a utilitarian component to beer, too, where it doesn't have to be all, you know, checking in on Untappd. It's sometimes just need an easy drinking beer to relax with at the end of the day.
Sure. So I, on our last show together, we did talk a bit about the Hakarl, the rotten shark out in Greenland?
Iceland.
Iceland,
yeah.
I got them mixed up. Apologies to the good people of Iceland here.
You don't have to apologize to the good people of Greenland because there's no one there.
Okay, good. Is there a beer that would hold up to Hakarl?
In my experience, no, because you're supposed to chase Hakarl. Rotten shark meat, for anyone who doesn't know, it's fermented Greenland shark, and that's probably your confusion, because it is the Greenland shark that's the shark that makes a Hakarl.
Yeah.
And it's highly toxic to humans if we eat it fresh. It lacks kidneys, so it pumps its urea throughout its body as a sort of natural antifreeze, which is allows it to survive in these extreme Arctic environments. It's a crazy, crazy animal. It's a really interesting animal to read about. I suggest you know, do some more homework outside of this podcast. But, so the Greenland shark is fermented into this very pungent, smelly delicacy. It has this like ammonia burn that just starts to burn your throat as you eat it. You're supposed to wash that down with the Icelandic national spirit, which is called Brennivín. And when we went, they didn't have any, and we didn't think to bring any. So we did have this 12% ABV, very strong, boozy, rich, malty Icelandic Imperial Stout. Like one of the heaviest beers you could possibly really come up with for this situation. A couple hours later, we had it, tried to wash down the residual lingering flavors of the Carl. Just tasted like shark. The beer just straight up tasted like oil made out of rotten shark. So I don't think there's any beer that can quite survive the Hakarl onslaught.
Hey, how long does that aftertaste linger for?
Hours. Yeah. Like, we could still taste it in our mouths when we were flying home, like, 2 days later.
Oh, my gosh.
You burp or something, and it's right back there. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to do the speed round. Are you up for it?
I probably not, but I'll give it a try.
It's just a customary question to ask if you're up for it, because we're going to do it anyway.
I know. I figured.
Okay. Underrated beer.
Probably most people in the beer industry will hate this answer, but I've recently been very much appreciating Saranac Brewery.
Okay, wow.
They're not cool. In the beer nerd circles, they're not a cool brewery. But they were pivotal in helping the craft beer movement start, a major player in the kind of early contract brewer
scene. Absolutely, yeah.
Making a lot of the beer that got this industry where it is, so I think, they deserve respect for that. And I also just kind of have this, kind of nostalgic kick that I'm going through where, appreciating Stewart Shops in upstate New York and just kind of been hiking a lot in the Catskills and enjoying the fall and just kind of appreciating the sort of laid-back, blue-collar atmosphere of upstate New York. Mm-hmm. I've always had a fondness for that sort of rural atmosphere. And Saranac Brewery goes like really, really well with that. They're just this unpretentious, kind of laid back upstate New York brewery that makes totally solid drinkable beers in a variety of styles. They don't really try to, they don't try to be what they're not. They don't try to like work too hard to impress you. They're just kind of solid blue collar, affordable beer.
Yeah.
You're camping in the Catskills and buy a 12-pack of cans, and I had a camping experience where I was drinking some, and I was like, yeah, there's nothing wrong with this. I appreciate this very much.
Good. So. Now, we've reviewed them on the show before and always give them credit for being there almost like an original gangster.
Exactly.
They're before the movement.
I don't think they get enough credit for that.
Yeah. Okay, good one, good one. Overrated beer.
All right, so, and this is obviously a tough one because, I don't want to really single out anyone and make them feel bad. So I'm going to go with the whole craft beer industry in general.
Oh, you heard it here, folks. Okay. Yep.
And I'm pretty much reiterating what I said 5 minutes ago, but just kind of everyone's need to sort of calm down and relax a little bit and appreciate things for what they are, not worry so much about chasing hype, and just kind of, sometimes appreciate simpler, easier beer styles that, aren't things that everyone's, in an uproar about, but are necessary parts of the beer industry, and just kind of, they are what they are, and they have their place, and you should enjoy them for that.
Good, so. Well said. Favorite bar for great beer?
So recently, I've really been appreciating this place called Stock Up in Beacon, and they are off the main street, they're off the main drags, they don't necessarily get all the tourist traffic that a lot of the places on Main Street and Beacon do. And I live, 2-3 blocks away, so it's right around the corner for me, so I'm a little biased there. But it's just this wonderful collection of necessary things to have in a small town like Beacon. They're doing a great job. They have a couple coolers of beer, very well curated selection. Great spot if you just want to pick up a bottle or can of something good, new and interesting. They have about six tap lines of really good stuff, reasonably priced. It's not a bar atmosphere, but it's a great place to hang out on a weekend or weekday night. And they have amazing food, and they're doing like really, really cool things with a limited food menu.
Yeah.
So it's kind of unique cafe, deli, beer shop combination. Really liking that.
Okay.
Lately.
Okay, good. Underrated author.
All right, yeah. So struggling with the author ones because my, you know, my opinions as a writer are...
Even just something you read recently that maybe is kind of flying under the radar.
Yeah, I mean, so I've kind of been on a nostalgia kick recently, and this, I guess, harkens back to my Saranac, upstate New York, easy blue-collar atmosphere. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, come from a blue-collar area. Yeah, and I've been on a bit of a nostalgia kick lately, which I think the whole country kind of has been with all these, like, you know, remakes and reboots and new Star Wars and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Revisiting, so I grew up reading fantasy novels, and I've been kind of revisiting that lately. So I've been kind of revisiting a lot of things that I was reading as a child and seeing where the genre has gone in a new direction. So I've actually been appreciating an author named China Myville.
Okay.
British author who does different take on fantasy, kind of surrealist, a surrealist spin on fantasy. So a lot of stuff's sort of set in the real world, but taken in just kind of a weird direction instead of the classic, you know, classic fantasy approach.
All right. Overrated author.
Right, and that's a very tough one too.
That
obviously,
is, that is. Somebody gets hurt on this.
So
one.
Yeah, I'm going to say the craft beer industry.
Nope, been used already. Sorry,
I can't do that again. Okay. Yeah, so I had to think really hard about these answers. So I don't really have very good ones, and I apologize. But
that's okay.
Again, revisiting the childhood.
Yeah, what's something that didn't hold up from your childhood?
Exactly. So yeah, so I was thinking about that, and I've been doing some writing projects lately, and kind of revisiting, you know, things that influenced me as a kid, and kind of shaped the type of writing and projects I like. And I think, like with the Fermented Man, I seem to like quests kind of projects. Like, I seem to be a project-oriented person.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time necessarily, like, just diving into the minutia of something day after day forever.
Yeah.
I like that sense of discovery and exploration, and that's what appealed to me about beer. It's what appealed to me about, you know, Wild Fermentation that led to the Fermented Man project, which was the very unique sort of quest. And I'm just kind of realizing how much that's affected my psyche and the writing projects that I want to approach in the future and all that. And one of the authors that I read a lot as a kid that I had realized did not hold it up as well or at all. Obviously, I read, you know, a bunch of Tolkien and all that stuff. There's a British author called Brian Jocks who wrote all these fantasy novels that I loved as a kid. It was probably like what I read more than anything else. And he wrote these fantasy novels that the characters were all anthropomorphized animals.
Okay.
So it's sort of like Watership Down.
Yeah, that's what came to mind.
Yeah, like Watership Down as if written by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Okay.
Like pure fantasy setting, not set in the real world. There's no humans. There's none of that, like, kind of dark, you know, dark societal commentary of Watership Down. Just like otters fighting ferrets and stuff in a fantasy setting. Very dorky, very nerdy. And I'm sad to say how much that probably influenced my interests from reading those throughout my whole childhood. And there's a thing with the fantasy genre, and people complain about this or talk about this with George R. R. Martin and Game of Thrones now. Fantasy writers love talking about what their characters are eating, and there's always these huge feasts, so you'll get like 8 pages of what all the characters in the book are eating.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a running gag complaint that people have about the fantasy genre. And I'm looking back at my childhood now in these books that I read, and Brian Jocks was really bad with this. There'd be like dozens of pages of just describing what characters were eating.
Yeah.
The feast in these, you know, talking animals, eating cheese. I'm like, oh wow, I grew up to be a food and beer writer who likes to travel. Interesting. I don't know, you know, coincidence or not, all this food literature, and here I am writing books about food. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
That's a good question. I do have some fiction projects I'm working on. Trying to sort out my next big nonfiction project now. Kind of still trying to figure that out, so I don't really have anything to announce at this point. But
okay.
I'd like to, you know, keep writing in the food and travel world. And along those lines, I'm also doing some hiking guides for New York. smaller projects, not, you know, not a narrative nonfiction project like From Men to Man.
Yeah.
But you know, keep exploring. That does seem to be a theme of my projects is, yeah, I don't know, like exploring new things, and you never know what's going to be next.
Right. Yeah. Still no agent.
Still no agent, yeah. Okay. Working on that now, so.
I gotcha.
Yeah. If I know any agents are listening to this and don't think I sound terrible, you know.
Yeah, well, Derek, you could follow him at Bear Flavored. That's the at sign, B-E-A-R Flavored. A big thank you to Derek Dellinger, author of The Fermented Man, A Year on the Front Lines of a Food Revolution. Thank you so much for coming by The Oath.
Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Good. All right, well, signing off here, but until next time, thanks for listening. This is Mike Malone at Books and Beer.